Time has come. Time has come. Well, time came that I forgot my mouse in my office, so I'm just going to have to do it that way. But the time has come for PSD Q&A night. Very, very excited about this. Thankful for your questions. Already had a lot of participation, had 6 questions submitted. Okay, and I plan to answer the questions in, I sound like a teleprompter a little bit, in the order in which they were received. I know that because I go about once a week, check in the box, see which ones are there, and I try to kind of keep them in order. And sometimes, as I've noted before in the handout that we passed out, if I, and more importantly the elders, determine that it's a question that's better answered in private or in person, I will come to you if you have submitted your name along with the question. But if you don't actually hear your question answered tonight, well, chances are very likely it just means I'm going to answer it next month. Okay, yours will be first up, okay, the following month. These will be comprehensive answers, okay? I want to answer these briefly so that we can get through. We're actually going to do 4 questions tonight. But at the same time, I want to give you enough information so that you don't feel like I'm just disregarding your question or taking it lightly. In fact, some of these you might think, wow, Brian, you're answering this way too much. But that's fine. I'd rather you have more information than not enough and feel like I shortchanged you and just kind of ignored your concern. All right, so with that said, let's get into question number 1. Turn to Exodus 33. That's where we're going to be for this question. Exodus 33. Because in Exodus 33:11, the text says that the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face. Yet just a few verses later in the same chapter in verse 20, God tells Moses, "You can't see my face, for no one can see me and live." So the question is, how do we reconcile these verses when they seem to contradict one another? I want to show you that in the text. Look in Exodus 33, verse 11. "Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. And when Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent." Well, then look down in verse 20. "But he said," and this is God speaking, "You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." Well, how do we deal with this? All of us recognize in English that we can use the same word, yet depending on the context, that word can actually take on a different meaning. For instance, let's use the word face, okay? Face. If a parent tells a child, "Sweetheart, you have food all over your face," the parent is talking about the part of our anatomy where our eyes are and our nose and our mouth are. But what if I say the rays, and I don't think I've ever said this, but what if I said the rays of sunshine cascaded over the face of the earth? What do I mean, that the earth has eyes and a nose and a mouth? Well, no. Face there means surface. See, on the outside, that's the face of the earth. But on the inside, that's the core of the earth. Well, what if I said, you know, she's so stubborn, she just refuses to face the facts. Well, now I'm not using face as a noun. Now I'm actually using it as a verb. It's not just the thing now. It's an action. It's something that somebody does. But this is also a figure of speech, isn't it? It's not that there are these objects floating around out there called facts. And whenever you come across a fact, well, you need to make an about face. You need to turn and face that fact. Well, that's not really what's going on. It's just a figure of speech to say you need to be honest with the truth. You need to accept the truth. Well, what's the point? Well, the Hebrew language, just like probably every language, works in the exact same way. The Hebrew word used for face in Exodus 33 in both passages is the exact word panim. But the truth is that word face in Hebrew is used at least 5 different ways in the Old Testament. And the meaning has to be determined by the context in which it is found. In fact, look in Exodus 33, verse 16. Because truthfully, we have several different uses of the word face in this chapter. Look in verse 16. "For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, and I and your people? Is it not by your going with us, so that we, I and your people, may be distinguished from all the people who are upon the face, the panim, of the earth. Well, he uses the word face there to describe the surface of the earth. Now our question is, what about verse 11? Well, I believe there's a big hint in that verse as to what he means. Because when he says, the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. I think that second part is huge and a very helpful clue. Because we've learned in our Psalms class, okay, that whenever you see the word like or as, we know that it's imagery. We know that it is a figure of speech. And the point of the phrase face-to-face here is to capture the intimacy of the relationship between God and Moses. It's not about Moses literally seeing the face of God. In fact, I'm not even sure it's accurate to say God literally has a face because he's a spirit. And there's a lot more I could say about that. Maybe you can put that in the question box for next month. But the point is, they're so close to each other relationally. All right, look in, keep a marker there. Go in Deuteronomy 5. I'm going to show you this. This is very interesting in this discussion. In Deuteronomy 5, Moses is talking to the Israelites. And he's referring back to Mount Sinai and what it was like there. And he says in Deuteronomy 5, verse 4, the Lord spoke to you face to face at the mountain from the midst of the fire. So Moses actually says God spoke to all of the Israelites face to face. Well, we know he can't be literally saying they got up super close to God so that they stood literally face to face with him, because they didn't even come near the mountain. They weren't even going to go up there. But the point again is God here is talking to the Israelites. Even from Sinai, he spoke to them as if he was in a close relationship. He didn't do that with any other nation, did he? Did he speak to any other nation face-to-face like he did to Israel? No. In fact, that's the point he makes in Deuteronomy 4. Okay. So, now go back to Exodus 33, verse 20. Folks, the word face here is also a figure of speech. But it's a figure to refer to God's full glory. Again, I don't think the point is, no, Moses, you can't see my eyes and my ears and my nose and my mouth. No, in fact, did you know Moses didn't even ask to see God's face? That's not what he asked. Look in verse 18. Verse 18, where'd it go? Okay, I put the marker in the wrong spot. Then Moses said, I pray you, show me your glory. He doesn't say, show me your face. He says, show me your glory. And then it's God who responds and says, no, you can't see my face. So you know that what God means by face there is his full glory. Illustration. It's like if a cop is questioning a witness and they witness a crime and they say, well, did you get a good look at the guy? And they say, well, you know, he had jeans on and he had a hoodie and his hair was kind of dark. And they say, okay, that's great. Did you get a look at his face? And then if they say, well, no, I just kind of only saw him from behind. Well, the cops are sad and kind of disappointed, right? Because it's only when you see the face of a person that you see that person in their fullness. And you really know their full identity and who they are. And I believe this is the same language in the way that God is using his face here. No one can see the fullness of God's glory and live, so God only shows Moses his back. Look in verse 23. Then I will take my hand away, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Again, I don't think this is literally, well, God has a back, and he looks exactly like us, and so he just kind of turns around. His point in saying back is, I'm only going to show you a portion of my glory. Just like if we witness somebody's back today in a crime, we didn't really see the fullness of that person. Okay? And this is also consistent with the way the New Testament writers talk about seeing God face to face as well. And ultimately, folks, I want you to see, this is the last point I'll make about this. This is the beauty of heaven. Because in Revelation 22 and verse 4, it says, of Christians, they will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. We'll see the full glory of God in heaven. Question number two. Look in Matthew 23. Because in Matthew 23 and verse 9, Jesus says not to call anyone on earth father. So how come it's okay to refer to our biological dads as father? Well, answer, again, the word for father here is actually the same word used of earthly fathers in the New Testament. It's just the word pater, but the context is going to have to tell us what's going on. And remember that in Matthew 23, this is a chapter all about Jesus' condemnation of the hypocrisy and the pride of the Pharisees and the scribes. And I want us to just read the verses surrounding verse 9, because I think it really sheds light on this issue. In verse 6, beginning, he says about the Pharisees, they love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, and respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. So you see that already in the surrounding text, whatever it is that Jesus is talking about, it has to do with the sin of pride. Because right after this verse, he says you need to humble yourselves and not exalt yourselves. And not only that, but he calls these terms respectful greetings. He says that the Pharisees love it when people greet them like this. What Jesus is condemning in these verses is two things. One, he's condemning the assigning of religious titles to people. Secondly, he's condemning the love of those religious titles by the people to whom they are assigned. You know, there's a difference between something I actually am and something that I want people to call me because it makes me feel good inside. Would it be okay for you to say, our preacher's name is Brian? Yes. Am I a preacher? Yes. Could you call me preacher if you wanted to? Yeah, I suppose you could. But what if you came up to me and you said, Brian, you know, I really need to talk. And I said, sorry, you need to refer to me as preacher Brian. Don't just call me Brian. You will refer to me as preacher, evangelist, whatever, fill in the blank. Well, there's a big difference there, isn't it? You see, some titles, well, they just state what you are, right? But others actually puff you up, and Jesus is condemning the latter. So in the same way, look in Ephesians 6. We call our dad's father, we assign him that title, but that's just really saying what he is. And that's why in Ephesians 6, for instance, Paul uses the same word. He says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So Paul actually calls dads fathers here. He uses the same word Jesus condemns back in Matthew 23. But the point is, he's just saying, that's what you are. You're a father. A father, at its most basic level, is a male who raises a child. And in most cases, the father is the originator of that child, unless it's an adopted child. This is why in Romans, Paul can refer to Abraham as the father of faith, because he is the originator of the Jewish nation. Even in 1 Corinthians 4, I find it interesting that Paul refers to himself as a father to the Corinthians. Well, again, he's not really being literal there. He's figuratively a father in the spiritual sense. But he really was their father because he gave birth to their faith by being the one who planted the seed of the gospel in their hearts. But did Paul tell the Corinthians, you all must address me as Father Paul? No, not at all. Because that would be assigning a religious title. The Pharisees, I think, it makes sense, doesn't it? That they loved being called Father because that term connotes wisdom and it connotes leadership. But you look at the life of the Pharisees, they weren't fathers at all. They may have been biological fathers, maybe they had children, but they were not spiritual fathers in any sense of the term. But they loved people calling them that because it made them feel superior. It made them feel special. Now, let me also say this. I believe that when it comes to assigning titles, Matthew 23 is limited to the religious realm. Okay? I don't think the point is you can't call your boss at work boss, or your teacher in a college class, you can't call them professor, or you can't call your football coach coach, or even your biological father dad. I don't think this is the point at all. Okay? But when it comes to loving the titles assigned to you and feeling prideful about that, that can happen in any realm, can't it? The professor can really think, well, no, you must refer to me as Dr. So-and-so, PhD. Well, okay, if that's what you are, that's fine. I'm fine with calling you doctor because you have a doctorate. But if that person is then feeling prideful and puffed up about that, well, then they're guilty of pride here. Okay. The main point, though, is in the religious context. Jesus is saying, don't view any human being who teaches you spiritual things higher than you should, because the ultimate teacher of spiritual things is God in heaven. And is this not exactly what has happened in denominations today, especially Catholicism? You have people listening to what Father so-and-so says and what Pope so-and-so says and what Reverend so-and-so says, but they're not listening to the true Father and the true Reverend in heaven. That's a serious issue. And Jesus is saying, if you happen to be the one who is the religious leader, don't think too highly of yourself either, because you're not really the leader at all. You're just a follower of the true leader in heaven. Third question. You guys are doing great. Third question. I'm just assuming this is making sense, and you'll let me know afterwards, I'm sure. Question number three. Who are the 144,000 in Revelation 7, verse 4? Well, let's first of all read the text. Let's go to Revelation 7, and we'll just read four verses here in 1 through 4. This is a great, great question. Very practical today because of all the misunderstanding Revelation. But he says this, after this, in verse 1, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, and saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And then he goes through and he lists from the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Asher and so on and so forth. So it appears to be some form of judgment scene, and yet this angel is saying, wait, before you judge the earth, make sure you seal these bondservants. And the number that was sealed were 144,000. First of all, it is one of the greatest tragedies of our modern society to see how many religious groups today base entire doctrinal positions, not even doctrinal positions, but entire theological systems based on taking things they read in the book of Revelation literally. For instance, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they take this literally and they believe that there will only be 144,000 people in heaven. And the rest of us will just be on earth. There's just a lot of problems with that. For one, these 144,000 are on earth and the multitude is in heaven, so they have it backwards. But I'll show you some other problems, glaring problems with that later. But Jehovah's Witnesses, not the only people who have a problem with this. Premillennialists in general, which is premillennialism is a philosophy that goes through multiple denominations today. They believe that these refer to the Jews that Jesus will teach and convert when Jesus comes back for the rapture. And whether they take the 144,000 literally or not, they definitely take it literally that these are Jews. Okay? And, of course, they get their whole rapture theology from a literal reading of Revelation 20, with the thousand-year reign and the multiple resurrections and all that. The problem today, folks, is that people just do not seem to understand that that's just not how Revelation works. And that's because this is unlike any literature that we see today. It's just so unique. But back in the first century world, Revelation was not unique at all, at least in its style. It was what was called apocalyptic literature. And there were all kinds of these writings that sound just like Revelation. It's just really neat. You can go online and look up apocalyptic literature, and it sounds just like Revelation. It's amazing. Okay, and there was a lot of it was written long before Revelation was written. And people knew back then that apocalyptic literature is all about painting pictures with elaborate and highly figurative imagery. Apocalyptic literature was meant to be seen more like a movie than read like a doctrinal treatise. So the language is highly visual. And one of the key characteristics of apocalyptic literature is the figurative use of numbers. And certain numbers had meaning buried within them. And it wasn't random. It wasn't like, well, we think this number should mean this. They actually had reasons behind why they assigned meaning to the numbers. So, for instance, the number 3 is a reference to deity or divinity. Why would that be? Well, because of God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. The number 4 is the reference to the earth. Why is that? Well, because of north, south, east, and west. In fact, did you notice back in verse 1 it said that the angels were on the four corners of the earth? The number 10 is a number for completeness, probably because, hey, humans have 10 fingers, 10 toes. And the number 12, that stood for God's people. Why is that? Well, because in the Old Testament, there were 12 tribes of Israel. In the New Testament, you had 12 apostles. Okay? Look in Revelation 5, because I want to just show you an example of it. You can go to dozens of places in Revelation to show this, but look in Revelation 5 and verse 6. Okay? And I'll just show you this figurative use of numbers in action. In verse 6, he says, "And I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing as if slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of God sent out into all the earth." Now here's the thing. People who want to take the 144,000 literally, they run into problems, because what they have to do is then they have to go through Revelation and pick and choose what to take literally and what to not take literally. So if they're going to take the 144,000 literally, they're going to have to take the 7 spirits of God literally as well. But there's a problem with that, because Ephesians chapter 4, verse 4 says there is only one spirit. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? That says one spirit. This says that there's 7 spirits of God. So should we develop this highly elaborate system about the spirits and give them all different names and come up with this whole... No, that's not the point of the text at all. So what does it mean? Well, 7 is the sum of 3 and 4. 3 is the number for deity. 4 is the number for the earth. So the number 7 is describing God's relationship to the earth. And he also uses figurative language about Jesus, describing him as a lamb. Jesus, of course, not a literal lamb. And this lamb, he says, has 7 horns and 7 eyes. Horns are used in Revelation to symbolize power. Eyes are used to symbolize knowledge and sight. So the point of saying that God has 7 spirits is to say that he is all-seeing and he is all-knowing and he is all-powerful on the earth. This is the point of God's 7 spirits going out across the earth. So what happens if we take the 144,000 literally in Revelation 7? Well, it means a few things. First of all, it means that only Jews will be in heaven, because they're from the tribes of Israel here. But did you know that the 144,000 actually shows up later in Revelation. Look in chapter 14. This is the second time and final time, I believe, where they show up. In Revelation 14, it says in verse 3, "And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as the first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless." So if we want to take them literally, we're also going to have to say that the 144,000 are all men, because he says they never defiled themselves with women. And also that phrase, not defiling yourself with women, also refers to virginity. So these are all unmarried Jewish men. They would be the only ones going to heaven if we take that literally. Well, clearly that's a fail, because neither of these views square with the rest of the Bible's teaching that all people, whether Jew or Gentile, will be in heaven if they put their obedient faith in Jesus Christ. Not only that, but those literal views just don't fit with how you're supposed to use Revelation. It's not appropriate to apocalyptic literature. So think about it this way. 144,000 is a multiple of 10 and 12. 10 represents human completeness, and 12 represents God's people. 144,000 is 10 times 10 times 10 times 12 times 12. I'm not a mathematician, but the point is that this is the complete number of God's people who are sealed and protected on the earth. Now, we are going to have to go a little bit further. Okay, we can't really stop here, because there seems to be another group that John sees in this same chapter. Go back to Revelation 7. He actually sees a great multitude which no one could count standing in heaven. This is what contributes to the problem today in people's interpretation, especially when they get literal. Look in Revelation 7, verses 9 and 10. After he lists all the 144,000 from Israel, he says in verse 9, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. And they cry out with a loud voice, saying, 'Salvation to our God who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb.'" So there are really two groups of people here in this text. There is the 144,000. But then there is also this innumerable host of people in heaven. And this is where you can see people start to get the idea, well, maybe there's multiple resurrections, and maybe this 144,000, they go up first in the rapture, and then later on they're going to be resurrected. There's just a much simpler, and not only simpler, but much more biblical explanation for these two groups of people. Revelation was written in a time of terrible Roman persecution in the late first century. And many Christians were put to death by the hands of the Romans. So what God does in Revelation is he divides his people up into two groups. The first group are those who would die in the persecution at that time. The second group are all those Christians who would later follow in their footsteps and follow Jesus and come meet them in heaven one day. It's really that simple. And this is consistent with the rest of the Bible too. For instance, you remember in 1 Thessalonians, they asked Paul, "Hey Paul, what about all those Christians who have died already? What's going to happen to them?" Well, Paul says, actually, they're going to be just fine. They're going to be resurrected first, and we're going to go and meet them in the air. Revelation does the same thing. It talks about these two groups of people, those who have already died here and now at the time that it was written, and those who will come later. It's the same thing Revelation 20 does when he talks about those who die will take part in the first resurrection. He's saying they're actually victorious. Whoops, I forgot to hit that. They're actually victorious, those who have been killed. But the rest of us, we won't follow until much later. after the 1,000 years, which again is just figurative for a complete period of time. And I'll show you why else I say that. I want to continue building that case for... actually, you know what? I skipped this part. This is very important. So let me actually tell you then what this is. The 144,000 is a reference to all of God's people who are sealed and saved during that particular persecution at that time. But the innumerable multitude that he sees, those are all of God's people saved for all time and forever. That will join them later in heaven. And again, I want to kind of drive this home, because look back in Revelation 14 with me. This will bring out another really helpful point, I think. In Revelation 14, we read this earlier, but look what he calls the 144,000 at the very end of verse 4. The very end of verse 4, he says, "These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb." The first fruits of a harvest is that first group of crops that come. And when that group of crops comes, it's a sign of more crops to come later. This is what he's saying about this 144,000. The point is, this is the faithful group of Christians who die in the persecution by the Romans, yet they reign victorious in heaven, and that's a sign of more faithful Christians who would follow in their footsteps later. You see that? They're the forerunners for all the Christians in the future who would be faithful unto death as martyrs and who would be joined to the multitudes in heaven. Now, here's the kicker. Are you wondering, why would God use Jewish language to describe the 144,000? Why would he talk about the 12 tribes of Israel? What's that about? Folks, that's the perfect language, because the Jews were the first fruits of salvation. That's why he uses that language. Israel is symbolic of the first fruits of God. So it's natural that he uses this symbolism of the 144,000 being from the 12 tribes of Israel. And if somebody wants to press you and say, no, that's literal 12 tribes, the 12 tribes aren't even all listed in that list. So it's not literal at all. Dan is not even there. Judah is first. What's the deal with that? It's not a literal list. It's just saying these are the first fruits of God. These are the ones that will reign in heaven because they stayed faithful. And just as the Israelites were the forerunners that paved the way for the gospel to come to the Gentiles, in like manner, these 144,000 are all the martyrs of the earth at that time killed for their faith, but they're really just the forerunners that paved the way for all Christians in the future who live faithfully unto death for Jesus Christ. Fourth and finally, turn to Matthew 27. This last one is much shorter than the others because I have no clue what the answer is. So, and I'm only half joking about that. In Matthew 27, it says that one of the things that happened when Jesus died on the cross, in addition to the earthquake and the darkness and the veil of the temple being torn, was that other saints rose from the grave. Why is this here, and what do we make of it? And you know, maybe you've never really even noticed that this was here, but look in verse 52. It says, "The tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many." Probably don't want to hear too many sermons on that. Not from me, anyway. And a lot of that, folks, is because, honestly, there's just not much information about this in the Bible. Matthew is the only gospel writer who mentions it and includes this detail, and it really doesn't seem like any other New Testament writer even mentions this. I'm amazed that in the book of Acts, all the times that Paul is trying to argue for the resurrection, how come he didn't just say, you know, remember all those people who were resurrected in Jesus' time? He doesn't mention it. He only focuses on Jesus' resurrection. And then there's also kind of some questions about the text. I mean, it says many bodies, but we don't know how many there really were. And also, there's debate about the timing and the details of how this worked. The wording, honestly, it's kind of strange, especially because you got to remember the original text was not punctuated. So, you know, we're trying to do our best and put the punctuation there. And depending on where the punctuation is, it can kind of change the meaning. So it almost looks like at the moment Jesus died, the tombs were open and the dead came to life, but they didn't actually come out of the tombs until after his resurrection. But if that's the case, what were they doing in the tombs for 3 days, you know, before Jesus was resurrected? But it may also be saying that the tombs opened when Jesus died, but they weren't actually raised to life until Jesus' resurrection. I'm really not exactly sure. But what is clear, I believe, is that Jesus' death and resurrection brought life. I believe really that's the main point of the text. But I do believe there may be something more in this. Okay, go with me to the Old Testament, to another weird passage. And I say weird because there's just not much information about it. In 2 Kings 13, it's strange to us because the text just kind of says it and then moves on. And there's really no... It just kind of surprises you and then you just keep reading because you don't really know what to do with it. 2 Kings 13, look in verse 14 first. Okay. 2 Kings 13, verse 14. When Elisha became sick with the illness of which he was to die, Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over him and said, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. So basically, Elisha is dying. He's sick. He's ill. And then in verse 20, it says, Elisha died, and they buried him. Now the bands of the Moabites would invade the land in the spring of the year. And as they were burying a man, behold, they saw a marauding band, and they cast the man into the grave of Elisha. And when the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. Now Hazael, king of Aram, had oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoaz. Yeah, you know, the text just keeps going. You're like, what? What just happened in verse 21? But keep reading, because in verse 22 he says, the king of Aram oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoaz. But the Lord was gracious to them, and he had compassion on them and turned to them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them or cast them from his presence until now. Again, not many details, but I believe that this is a foreshadowing. These people who were burying this man, this is a foreshadowing of God casting his own people in the grave by bringing judgment on the northern kingdom of Israel. And I get that not only from the context that this is really nearing the time when God's going to judge them by the hands of the Assyrians, but also the words that are used. Okay, because the language in verse 21 says that they cast the man into the grave of Elisha. But then in verse 23, God says it's only by his grace and faithfulness to the covenant that he had not cast the Israelites from his presence until now. But you know what? They had become so wicked that it was time to cast them away. And that's what we see four chapters later. Look in 2 Kings 17. 2 Kings 17, and this is the last verse we'll look at tonight. 2 Kings 17, verse 20, the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hand of the plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. It's the same Hebrew word used in all those places there. So just like that dead Israelite was cast into a grave, so too would the entire nation of Israel be cast into the grave. But what would bring them back to life? Well, coming into contact with God's buried prophet. Now, I know that Elisha died a natural death here, but because the people didn't really listen to him, well, they might as well have killed him and buried him because they weren't paying attention to him. But the point is, if they would go back and remember his words, they could be brought back from the grave. They could be saved. And in like manner, remember that Matthew's gospel was written to Jews. And in the final chapters of Matthew, Jesus calls down judgments upon the nation of Israel, its religious leaders, and even its temple. And then Jesus dies with none of his countrymen truly following his words. Yet even in death, when all hope for Israel seemed lost, there were faithful Israelites who were brought back from the grave. That's what he means by saints there, holy ones. These were Israelite saints. So too, if they would only come, these Israelites, if they would only come into contact with Jesus' death, by following His words, being buried with Him in baptism, they could be raised to newness of life like He was and like that Israelite was back in 2 Kings 13 when he came in contact with one of God's prophets. The question tonight is, has Jesus' death and resurrection raised us from the dead, or are we still in the grave? If you're still in the grave tonight, you don't have to be. You can be raised to newness of life by being buried with Him in the waters of baptism. If you'll come to Him in faith, we can help you to do that. We're here to do that for you, and we're so glad to do that for you. And if you've already done that, but you've wandered off and not been faithful, come forward. Let us help you. Always stand and sing.